Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Jill McLennan. Jill McLennan is a certified death doula, and she completed a death doula mentorship with Jill Schock of Death Doula LA in August of 2020. Her passion for holistic healing also led her to pursue a 9-month apprenticeship in shamanic healing techniques with Lilith Moon of Shamanic Yoga in 2021. Through her training as a death doula, Jill found a renewed sense of gratitude for life. The joy of being with her family made Jill even more passionate about helping others heal before they face death. In January of 2023, Jill created a podcast, Seeing Death Clearly, to help people get comfortable hearing conversations about death, dying, and grief, while also learning that by embracing our mortality, we can live a better life. Jill, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I've been looking forward to having a conversation with you for a while now.
Oh, thank you so much, Dave, for having me. And I've been looking forward to this as well. So I'm excited.
Me too. And we got to throw a shout out to Chris Mamone. He introduced us. I know you were a guest on his marvelous podcast, and he thought we would be a good fit for each other based on our backgrounds and our interests and our journeys. And, you know, he hit the nail right on the head. And here we are today recording a podcast.
Yeah, Chris has definitely been a good connector for podcast guests within the grief space, which I know is not everybody's cup of tea to talk about grief, but he's definitely connected me and connected a bunch of us together. So I think we're kind of all making the podcast circuit now, thanks to Chris.
Absolutely. And what I've learned since I've been doing podcasting for the last 2.5+ years is that there's a great community of podcasters who really support each other. I mean, we exchanged referrals for guest contributors. We support each other. You know, we share things that we've discovered that have helped make the editing process easier. So it's just really a great supportive community, I think, which mirrors other supportive communities that we need to embrace during challenging times.
Yes, it has been a really great community. And it was one of those things where I thought about starting a podcast for years before I actually did it. I'm getting ready to go into my 4th year, which is crazy. But I don't know the tech, you know, like I'm not a tech person. And I was just guesting on other people's podcasts. And every time I'd say, I don't know, I'm a little anxious, I'm a little nervous. So many people were just like, I'll teach you how to do it. It's not that big of a deal. Let me help you. So yes, the podcasting community has been so supportive and helpful in just getting it off the ground and keeping it going. And like you said, just making things easier, plus connecting people with interesting guests. So yeah, I love it. I love my podcast. I love being a guest on other people's podcasts. I just really enjoy the whole space.
Yeah, me too. And I enjoy podcasting, having really impactful individuals on my podcast and also guesting on other podcasts. It's been a fun experience for me.
Yeah. Well, you'll be on mine soon. I'm excited.
Yeah, me too. I think the end of October we're recording.
Correct. Yeah. It doesn't come out for a little while. I don't know about you, but I get really ahead of myself. But that's partially because, again, being a guest on somebody's podcast, I've had people reach out to me almost in a panic of, oh, my guest canceled this week and I need one because I need to put it out by Friday. And I'm like, today's Tuesday. What are you doing? So I get way ahead of myself, which is just the way I like to do it. If something's time sensitive, I'll rearrange my schedule. But for the most part, I have every podcast. So this is October 15th. I have every podcast either recorded or scheduled until March of 2026, because I just don't ever want to have that panic of, oh my gosh, I have to get an episode out. I do try to be consistent and get one out every week. I've also learned to be gentle with myself. If something happens and I just can't get it done that week, I used to try to force myself. You have to stay, because that's what everybody tells you. You have to be consistent. It has to be the exact same time, the exact same day, all that stuff. Now I'm just like, look, I get it done pretty much regularly. If I miss a week because, I don't know, something happens, somebody gets sick, I don't know. It's going to have to be okay. I look for quality of the content of the podcast versus quality of the podcast itself being perfect with that stuff. I don't have time for that.
Well, and I think most individuals who respond positively to a podcast respond to the nature of the conversation, not in terms of there was a word that they couldn't understand or, you know, you don't really get that. It's just like, generally, if the conversation's impactful, that's all they care about.
Yeah, I know. And that's why I love podcasting, because I love the conversation. I feel like the guests that I have come on, or if I'm a guest on somebody else's podcast, especially because I love talking about a subject that's so untalked about, you know, death and dying and grief is not a common conversation. I know that me being a guest on other people's podcasts is exposing people to this idea that you can have this conversation. It doesn't have to be morbid. It doesn't have to be scary. It doesn't have to be overwhelming. And then when I had guests on my podcast, I learned from every one of my guests. I look at it almost as paying for an education, you know, because I don't make money on my podcast. So I pay for all the stuff that I need to pay for out of my pocket, essentially. But I look at it as an education, because everybody that comes on, I learn something new from them that then I can go out and help my clients better when I'm working with people who are dealing with death anxiety or grief or whatever aspect that it is. So it is, it's an amazing thing. And I am so grateful that I got over my fears and decided to just jump in and do it. And of course, you know, I listen to my earlier episodes and I'm like, oh my gosh, they're terrible. But, you know, like everything else, you just get better as you do it. And so if anybody listens to my first couple episodes, I apologize. They're a little, wonky, but I promise you they do get better with time.
Yeah, I think my earlier episodes too were probably not as good quality as my later episodes have been, but it's just with experience, every mistake we make or every misstep is information in terms of how we could do something better. And that's all that really matters. And again, individuals are going to look at, was this a good conversation? Did this help me? Did my guest contributor and the podcaster give me some tools which I could use to transcend my own challenge, to get over my fear of talking about death, to take the mystery out of it? And speaking of which, I need to ask you, one of my first questions that I ask every guest contributor is, what were the primary experiences that have gotten you to this point where you've become a shamanic healer, where you become a certified death dealer? Give our audience just a little bit of the backstory that got you to this point.
Yeah, it's a story, I think, with people in end of life space, in that we had our experience with somebody that we loved. Either it was a bad experience, or thankfully in my case, it was a mainly good experience. I realized how unprepared I was. You know, when I was about 27. I was living in California at the time. I was the pastry chef at a restaurant in San Francisco, living my life. I just got married. I was doing all the stuff. And my grandmother was getting ready to turn 90. She lived in the same house my grandfather built for her when they got married in 1937. So she really wanted to stay in that house. And I wanted to open a bakery. And we were on the phone one day, because I called her literally every single day. And she said, well, why don't you and Steven move home here to New Jersey and you can live with me? And then this way I can stay in my house, but you don't have to pay rent. If you live here and make sure that I can stay here safely, you don't have to pay me rent. And then you can open your bakery. So, you know, bring this up to my husband. We had just gotten married. He's from Florida originally, not from New Jersey. So I'm like, what do you think? We moved to small town New Jersey and opened a bakery. Thankfully, he was very supportive. He still is very supportive of me. And right after we moved in with my grandmother, It was about a week later. She said, I have this weird lump in my chest, not in her breast, but it was in her chest. And we took her to the doctor, and the doctor said, it's probably not cancer. It's a weird spot for cancer. It's probably just a little tumor. We'll just take it out. No big deal. And when he went in to take it out, he said, actually, I'm wrong. That actually is cancer. It's a very rare cancer. Typically, we only find it in teenage boys, not in 90-year-old women. And so we started this journey of putting a 90-year-old through radiation, through surgeries, through chemo, through all of these things that now, knowing what I know, we would not have done for a 90-year-old, but I didn't know any better. I just went along with what the doctors told me because that's what we do. And the last 4 years of her life, they were difficult. I mean, they could have been a lot worse, but they were really challenging on her. They were really hard on me. During that time, I did open the bakery. I had a baby. Life just kept moving. And so the last couple of weeks of her life when she was on hospice, I had a 6-month-old baby. And the hospital basically sent her home. We brought her in because she was having some problems. And they said, there's really nothing else we could do at this point. We're going to put her on hospice care. Who takes care of her? And I was like, oh, that's me. I live with her. I take care of her. And they're like, okay, here you go. Here's grandma. And literally that first night, she didn't know who I was. She thought that I was the nurse. And she kept saying to me, my granddaughter has a baby the same age as yours. Because when you have a 6-month-old, I was up at 1 a.m. with him and with her trying to like get this whole situation under control. I was so upset by the time that hospice showed up. I was so confused. I was so overwhelmed. And they just sat me down and they were like, look, this is totally normal. This is totally natural. Your grandmother not recognizing you, especially in the middle of the night, like this happens regularly. Hospice was amazing, amazing. And so after my grandmother died, I sent almost immediately, actually, even at one point, I was talking to one of the hospice nurses while she was doing her job. And I was like, I think I want to do what you do, but I don't think I could do like that, like the nursing stuff. And she's like, oh, you could do this. You would be great at this work. But, you know, having a 6-month-old and having a bakery, I just could not imagine going back to school to start all over again, to become a nurse and then to get into hospice, to do the whole thing. And then life just kept moving. And in 2019, I heard somebody mention on a podcast that they were a death doula. And as they explained what they did, I said, oh, that's it. That's it. That's what I'm supposed to do. It was like, when they talk about your body almost lighting up when you hear your purpose, that's what it felt like. It was like my whole body was like, that is what you're supposed to do. So at that point, I was turning 40 years old, getting ready to completely change my life, leave behind a career that I'd had for many years. At that point, I had 2 kids. I had 2 jobs. I was just like, but I'm going to do this. And so again, face those fears of, are you crazy? What are you doing? I started researching trainings and then I just kind of dove in. And now it's, my gosh, let's see, I just turned 47 yesterday, 2 days ago. So it's been 7 years now since that moment of hearing it and realizing that this is my purpose. I really do truly feel that it took me a while to find it, but this is what I was put on this planet to do. This is my purpose. This is my work. Trying to tie in some of the shamanic healing stuff, I don't do it actually with a lot of clients. I do find that most of my clients are really looking more for the practical end. But what I have found is for me, it's a very useful tool, especially if I'm sitting with somebody that's dying. And they're not talking because they're in basically a coma towards the end of life. If I'm in a hospital, I might not know them. I don't know anything about them other than what's in their hospital records. And so I'll sit and I will journey myself, right? I go within and I journey myself and I try to connect with their soul in a way where it gives me something to do. But like in some ways, we are so nonstop nail in our culture that if you try to sit with somebody that can't talk to you and focus your energy just on them, it will start to make you feel agitated. Your body, your mind, everything wants to move. And so I found that that is a really helpful tool for me And I will try to meet them there and I will try to comfort them. And I will talk to them myself. You know, I talk to them out loud, but there's really only so much you can say when you don't know a person. So I'm finding that I use the shamanic healing tools more for myself than actually with clients. Most of my clients are like, I just want the practical help. I want the planning. I want the trainings. I want that type of stuff. So, you know, I'm open to seeing where my path leads over the next few years. I actually did just do a funeral celebrate training too. So I'm adding that to my services, my experience to, again, continue this work, not just before the death, not just during the death, but after the death, supporting families, helping them create a meaningful ceremony for their loved ones, where I tell the loved one's story in a way that really helps heal the families and helps them work through their grief. And so I'm excited now to see where this path takes me, where this little bit of my journey goes.
Yeah, and it's all in alignment. Your work as a certified death doula, your work with shamanic healing, and also now as a funeral celebrant, I can see all of that coming into alignment. But the common denominator is that it's going to demystify the stigma around death and about talking about it. What funeral celebrants now are looking at is not so much grieving the actual physical death, but celebrating the life of that individual. It's about creating those bonds right from the moment that person transitions and creating lasting memories that the surviving members, family members, and friends could use that information, transform the relationship, and create those continued bonds. So I think what you're doing is very meaningful, and I'm excited just to see what other paths open up for you too.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I do love as well that in my funeral celebrant training, because I haven't done an actual funeral yet. I'm kind of still, again, this was like less than a month ago that I did the training. So I'm getting there. But one of the things that I loved so much is they were saying how we want to tell the full story of the person. We're not going to sugarcoat it, because so many times you'll read these, you know, obituaries or you go to a funeral service and they're just very... It's like they just took a template and just like filled in a little bit of information, and it's only the good things. And the woman that trained me, she was like, we need to tell the full story. So we don't shy away from talking about maybe some of their bad habits, some of the things that they did that drove people crazy. But even the part of telling the story for the family, if somebody dies in a tragic way, an overdose, death by suicide, where so many times our culture doesn't want to talk about it. There's so much shame tied with that. And Glenda, the woman that trained me, she said, this is a gift that we can give those families, where we can be that person to talk about the struggles that they had, especially if it was a death by suicide or overdose, where there's blame almost placed on the person, like they did that to themselves. Yes. Where we can tell the story of just the struggles that they had and how this unfortunately was the choice that they ended up making, or it was the unfortunate outcome of an addiction, so that the families don't have to answer those questions. So the families don't have to be the ones to say it. And we can write that into a story. And she used examples. And I loved this as well with the training, because the examples that she used, it wasn't a 90-year-old grandma that died peacefully and had a beautiful life story. She gave us the really hard ones. Children that died, the death by suicide, the overdoses, those were the examples that she used. And then also when she had us write our own story as a practice one, she challenged us to really use difficult stories. And so I picked one. The car accident by me in the spring, a 17-year-old killed himself, his two best friends, driving down the highway, doing the thing where he was going in and out of cars, decided to go onto the shoulder to get around a car, didn't realize there was a minivan stopped there with a woman and her three children, flipped their van. Thankfully, all of them survived. And I remember reading this story in the news and hearing about it and feeling really angry about the story and really having a hard time. I just like judging this young person about these lives that he ruined. And just, I had a hard time, especially having children myself, thinking that could have been my son. That could have been me. I drive down that highway all the time. Could have been me pulled over on the side with my kids in my van.
Yep.
I just had such a difficult time. And I was like, you know what, Jill? You are going to pick the hardest one. If somebody came to you and said, would you do a funeral celebration for this kid? I would have really struggled. And it makes me tear up thinking about it because I was able to humanize him. I researched as best as I could about him, reading stories that people posted online about him from his school teachers, from his friends, from his family. And I was able to tell the story of him and pointing out in the story that we can't judge him based off of this one poor decision. He was a much bigger person than that. And it sounds like he was a really lovely young man. And it just gave me so much compassion for him and his family. And it really does make me emotional because this is work that I know I can do and that I can help the world heal some of that hatred and judgment that we feel towards people, that we look at them as the other that did something really bad, not realizing that that could have been me. I could have at some point been a drunk driver. I mean, unfortunately, when I was younger, there was times I drove I probably should not have. I could have easily killed somebody, but it's really easy to judge the other people and not look at ourselves and say that could have been me. And so I'm so honored when people bring me into this space with them, whether it's a loved one that's dying or Nail, being able to go in and listen to somebody's story and be that person that tells the full story of a person that has died, celebrating their life in completeness, not just they were this person that everybody loved in the community. I don't want that. I want people to tell my full story. I'm not perfect. Talk about all the crazy stuff I do. I don't care. I want people to know the real me when I'm gone. But, you know, that's the work that I do. And that's why I love it so much.
You mentioned doing stories about individuals who died from addiction or suicide. And there is such a stigma attached to that, where the surviving family members feel shame, guilt, and the what ifs paralyze them. Mm-hmm. And for me, like you said, you shouldn't judge the totality of a person's life by their one final act. For somebody who's addicted, somebody who's had mental health struggles, we don't judge their life by their struggles with addiction or their dance with mental health challenges. We take a look at what tracks did they leave behind? What tracks did they leave that can carry on in legacies in others? That can carry on in the actions of others. And as a former addictions counselor, one of the things that I understood is that for individuals who came in with a history of addiction, there were also periods of sobriety where they were doing some excellent service work. And that can't be forgotten when we're trying to construct other individual stories. And you're right, it's also easy to idealize somebody in death. My daughter, who transitioned over 18 years ago, I love her dearly. But were there times where I was pulling my hair out over some of the stuff she did? Absolutely. And a little amount of hair I got now is probably, you know, some of the stuff that she did that just had me worried beyond worried. Mm-hmm. But overall, she was, I love the complete package. I love the yin and the yang about her. And that's something that we need to understand, that our loved ones aren't perfect, but they were authentic in terms of who they were. The yin and the yang make them who they are. Made them as special as they were. And to denounce their negative qualities or undesirable qualities is to deny a really good part of their existence, which we really don't want to do, especially when we are charged with carrying the legacies of our loved ones forward.
That's beautifully said. And working with people that have gone through addiction. I was not a counselor, but I was doing job training, teaching people how to bake and cook and all those things. And we did have people that had suffered really, deep addictions. Unfortunately, some of them would also end up relapsing and overdosing, including while they were in school. I found somebody once overdosed in the bathroom. It's it's such a challenging thing where if somebody dies from cancer, we don't judge them for their cancer coming back.
Right.
But addiction is not there because of a weakness. People get addicted to drugs, to alcohol, to all kinds of things because they're trying to numb a pain. They're trying to find something that makes them feel better. Typically, there was some type of trauma that happened to them, especially, you know, if they were younger, something bad happened. Drugs and alcohol are a real easy way to numb that. And so why is it that we look at them like it's a failure, especially, again, even if it's suicide? You know, mental illness is an illness. Why is it that if somebody dies from cancer, we're not like, oh, gosh, they died from cancer? But yet suicide and addiction, we view it so differently when it's still a death that they did not have control over. And even when it comes to suicide, one of the things that's legal in New Jersey, and I know this was something that I did yesterday, which is why today's podcast recording, I was like, we're going to see how I feel, because in New Jersey and in other states around the United States, what they call medical aid in dying is legal. And there are still people that are like, oh, so, it, you know, you helped somebody, you know, die by suicide, commit suicide. I'm like, no, I didn't. They were dying. They just chose when they were going to end their own suffering. Yeah. And it's frustrating because we do this for pets all the time. If a pet is suffering and in pain, I don't think there's anybody that would hesitate to take the pet to the vet. And, you know, we always say put them to sleep, right? Because that sounds better. We're going to put them to sleep. When really it is a choice that I think as a adult, if, you know, the person yesterday, they had stage 4 lung cancer. They were basically at the point where they were drowning in their lungs. Mm-hmm. And it just was too much. And they were ready to end that suffering. And it feels to me that that is such a gift for me to be able to support them and their family through that process, to make it easier. And it's such a beautiful death. It is so much better than when I've gone into the hospital and I've watched people that are intubated, hooked up to all these machines. It's like this nonstop process of keeping this body alive. And then the family has to be the ones to say, yes, it's time. Can you please turn all these things off? That is a terrible death. That is the death that I don't want people to have. But this yesterday, it was beautiful. I left the family alone. I was in the other room. I could hear them laughing and talking and listening to music. And just, it was so beautiful. And one of the spouses of the children said, because the parents were actually divorced, they hadn't even seen each other in 4 years since their divorce, but they really wanted to be together for this moment. One of the spouses said to me, I don't know the last time all of them have been in the same room together. This is really amazing to hear them like that. So it's beautiful to be able to have that option.
I agree. And in my death, dying, and bereavement course that I teach at Utica University, we talk about medical aid in dying. And we talk about the polarization that's occurred around that topic for moralistic reasons, for religious reasons. But one of the things that I believe every state in the union should have an option for individuals and families who wish to explore that option to have a medical aid in dying option, not to replace any other standard healthcare choices, because I'm a firm believer in freedom of choice. Mm-hmm. But I also believe medical aid in dying should be an option across the board. As somebody who has seen two people that I care dearly for die from cancer and watch them waste away and watch what it did to me, watch what it did to my family when my daughter transitioned due to cancer, I would be the first one to move to a state, either Vermont or New Jersey, try to establish residency and opt for medical aid in dying if standard medical treatment wasn't going to provide a good quality of life outcome for me. Because for me, it's not about sanctity of life at that point. It's about quality of life. And when my quality of life becomes impaired, sanctity of life also becomes impaired. I don't want to be maintained on life support. I don't want to see my family maintained on life support. I think in addition to New Jersey, Jill, there's only 10 more states in the union that have medical aid in dying legislation. And New York has passed it, but I don't know if our governor here has yet signed it. But I know it's been passed here, and it's just pending her signature. So, and I'm hoping that gets enacted into law here in New York State.
Vermont actually just recently made it so you don't have to be a resident anymore. There's a new, yeah. So I think that's really helpful because you're right. People have been trying to move to a state during a time when you don't need to be moving around. Like, this is not a time in your life when you want to have to move. But if you wanted to be able to utilize it, and that's the thing too, to make sure I clarify as well, the person still needs to be able to ingest the medication.
Yeah.
So in New Jersey, you mix it and you put it into a glass with a straw. They need to be able to drink it. Or there is a way to do it rectally where they put some type of a tube. I've never done it that way, but there is a way to do it that way. But they still need to be able to push the medication through the tube themselves. They're very, very strict in the United States about that. In Canada, you can actually have an option of euthanasia, which is where the doctor would actually give you the medication through an IV. I actually did have somebody on my podcast where her father had had a stroke. So he physically would not have been able to do it. And after years of living and just deterioration, he chose that option. And it is frustrating because there is still a lot of stigma around it. Even in the medical community, there are doctors still that think that this goes against their oath of causing no harm. But I am with you where I think people should pursue whatever treatments they want to pursue. I also think that we should have better conversations. I have a whole list of questions that I give clients. And I even had this happen in like 3 years ago. My mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. She was 76 at the time. I talked to the surgeon, asked a bunch of questions, and she said, honestly, in my professional opinion, any radiation or chemo at your mother's age would not be helpful. It would just cause more harm than it would do good. I don't see the benefit. There's studies that show there's no benefit. When I talked to the oncologist, this woman was mad. She was not happy with me. When we asked her questions and we said, my mother decided she's not doing radiation or chemo. And she said, well, then I can't promise you it's not coming back. That's fine. We will take that risk. Because after watching what it did to my mother said, you know what? If it comes back in 10 years, I'd rather have quality 10 years. And really, the thing that killed my grandmother wasn't even the cancer. It was the infection that she got from the radiation because it left such a wound in her body that's what got infected. That's really what killed her. And so my mother decided not to go ahead with radiation and chemo. She got the surgery. She's been getting her mammograms. She's doing all the things she needs to do. And now me at 47, sure, I would do the radiation. I would do the chemo. I would do everything I had to make sure that I potentially can live another 40 years for my children. But at 80, no, thank you. I don't want any of that. And I wouldn't choose that. But if other people want to, I'll support them through that as well, if that's their choice.
Absolutely. And I think in the interest of free will, in the context of free will, we live life on our own terms. We should be able to die or exit this world on our own terms, whatever those terms may be. That's why the good Lord gave us free will.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't die on their own terms.
No. Most people want to die at home. And really about 70 to 75%, I think, die at a hospital where the technology is, and actually about another 25% just die at home. And, you know, with my daughter, Janine, we had hospice services for the last 10 days of her life. She was able to die at home with her family around her, but not everybody's afforded that luxury. In defense of doctors, and I got to defend them just a bit, they do take death personally. They take their Hippocratic Oath personally. They know death is part of the deal, but when they're faced with losing a client, it's like another gear kicks in where we got to save them. We got to save them at all costs because they take death so personally, and it bothers them immensely. But I think when you're talking about end of life, the family's going to drive the bus, and the questions that need to be weighed: when does quality of life become compromised? When does the treatment that we do to an individual compromise quality of life? If quality of life is then compromised, should that family be allowed to make a decision that is in the best interest of preserving whatever quality of life they have left?
And I love palliative care. It's something that I didn't know existed until I became a death doula. I try to preach that to everybody, right? That's one of my soapboxes, is I'm like, look, if you had any diagnosis that is life-altering, even if you're going to pursue treatments, talk to palliative care, because they do such a good job at supporting a person through that journey and honoring what is important to them in a way that other areas don't. Because again, an oncologist wants to do their job, right? Which is taking care of the cancer in the way that they need to take care of the cancer. The surgeons want to do their job. Everybody has their specialty, which is great. Palliative care is really there just to say, what's important to you along this journey? We're going to make sure that you're as comfortable as possible as you go through this journey. With hospice, you have to stop treatments. It has to be at the point where you're like, I'm done treatment. I don't want to do anything else. Just keep me comfortable for as long as I'm alive. Most people don't utilize hospice early enough. Like you said, your daughter was 10 days. My grandmother was about 3 weeks. You can use hospice for 6 months. And even if you live longer than that 6 months, they're not going to kick you off. Eventually, maybe if it's been a year and a half, 2 years, they might say, all right, we're going to move you off hospice. But most people don't use hospice as long as they could. But palliative care, you can still pursue all of your treatments. They're just going to help support you. And there's doctors, palliative care social workers. They're the best. I have friends that are palliative care social workers, and they just are the best at working with clients around this space of treatments and fears about death and what are we going to do? So really, you know, if you have any diagnosis that completely alters your life, where you have to change the way that you live, talk to a palliative care team and get them involved in your care, because they will help you just bridge all those different people that you're working with and making sure that you are the center and what you want is the center of what's happening.
Makes sense. Makes sense. And I'm a firm advocate for palliative care as well, too. And again, that goes with my belief that quality of life is the most important thing that we need to consider throughout our lifetime. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll give you a hypothetical scenario. I'm a person, let's say, who's got a family member who's dying, and I come across your website, End of Life Clarity, and I want to retain your services as a death doula. What can I expect from you? What are you going to expect from the family?
The first thing that I do is a call to just get very clear on what's going on with the family and the situation. If the person that is ill, if they are able to, I want to start with an end-of-life care plan with them, which is a document that I do. It's similar to the Five Wishes, if anybody's heard of Five Wishes before. Yeah. But I kind of pieced together my own version of questions from the Five Wishes and other advanced healthcare directives to figure out what's important for me to help my clients. So we talk about physically what they would want. I talk about what their values are, emotionally, spiritually. It's a document that takes me about 3 hours to go through with the family, not all at once. You know, I break it up over time. And then I will have a conversation with the person who filled out the document with me and with anybody that needs to be on that call, spouses, children, siblings, if siblings are involved in care, so that we're all on the same page of this is what's important. This is the decisions that, you know, your parent or whoever it is decided. And we just want to make sure that everybody's on board to help support them along this journey. ideally, we should try to do that. Sometimes people contact me and it's like the moment of panic. You know, mom's in the hospital, she's dying, she can't talk to me, I'm overwhelmed, I'm confused, I don't know what's going on. In that case, I'm just going to jump right in. I show up at the hospital, do the best I can to support the family, to help them ask the questions, to help them have the conversation, and literally sit there with them if I need to for hours, just supporting and holding them and making sure that they don't feel scared and overwhelmed. It's very individualized service where I do try to just fill the need for whatever that family is. Sometimes there's that in between where maybe the person's not as verbal. They're not going to be as able to communicate with me their wishes, but they're not necessarily in crisis either. Then it's going to be helping the family understand what to expect. So I have worksheets, I have all the stuff where whatever it is they need, do you need to know what the signs of death are? Do you want to have a conversation of what to expect? Because it's not pretty when somebody dies, no matter how quote unquote good of a death it is. There's going to be some noises, potentially some smells, their skin color is going to change, right? It's something that if we don't know that, it doesn't look like it does on TV. And so I almost do what I would call caregiver training, helping the caregiver understand what they're doing, what's going on. And then I just support them almost like I say coach because I'm not a counselor, I'm not a therapist, but we can get on a call and just talk about what's going on. One of my clients, for years, I supported her through her grandfather's cancer diagnosis. And we got on a call every couple months, just checking in. How's everybody doing? How's everything going? And then when it was time for him to like actively die, I was on the phone with her all day long. I unfortunately was away on vacation, right? So like I couldn't actually physically be there with her, but I was like, you are fine. You are ready for this. You're prepared. And I just talked her through it. And, you know, he fell out of bed. What do we do? You know, I found all the phone numbers that she needed to call. So I'm really just kind of there helping support so that the family can focus on being with their loved ones, not going, well, I don't know who to call. How do I find this phone number? I need to sit with my grandfather because he's laying on the floor. I found all the numbers, called the people. They came, they assisted, got him back in bed. That's kind of the work that I do.
Yeah, it does sound like a very individualized process. And there are a lot of times you're with the family at the moment that their loved ones transitions. That has to be, I think, an emotionally moving experience. It would be for me being able to witness a person's, and I call it transition from one existence to a new existence, kind of like a rebirth into a new existence. What have been the personal benefits to you of doing what you do as a death doula and helping individuals manage end-of-life situations?
It completely changed the way that I live my life. I cannot stress this enough to people that if you get okay, if you prepare yourself for the fact that one day your life is going to end, and one day everybody that you love, their life is going to end, you will live your life differently. It's not just me that says it. So many people that I talk to that are death doulas or work in palliative care or hospice or whatever it is, they all say the same thing. We are so much more present in our everyday life with our loved ones than we used to be before we started doing this work. And it seems morbid to people sometimes when I say, like, I know that my husband, you know, he just drove up to North Jersey, like an hour away. I know he might not come home. Somebody's husband is not going to come home, right? Somebody's husband's going to die in a car accident or a heart attack or something like that. Am I okay with that? No, I'm not okay with it. But you know what it does is when he does leave the house, I make sure that I make eye contact with him. I make sure I tell them how much I love him. I make sure that I stop what I'm doing to connect before he leaves the house, because I know that it could be me. I'm not special. And even with my children, I did a podcast interview with a guy last week whose 20-year-old daughter died in a car accident. And that night, I said, you know, I am going to give my babies extra love. And I hugged them and I gave them kisses and I told them how much I love them. And it's sad when I have these conversations, or it's sad if I'm in the hospital with somebody and maybe it's their parent, maybe it's their spouse, maybe it is their child is dying. But it has made me appreciate every single moment that I'm here and that my loved ones are here in a way that I couldn't do before this. And again, I was on like a spiritual path since probably about 10 years old. I realized that there was something more than just the Catholic upbringing. So, I mean, I've been searching for this presence and this appreciation and gratitude for life for many, many years. And the thing that finally got me there, I tried yoga, I tried Hinduism and Buddhism. I mean, I tried the drugs, I tried the sex, I tried all the stuff that people are out there selling you. And nothing ever did it until I got okay with the fact that this is the only moment that I have for sure. And I'm going to appreciate my family and my loved ones to the fullest while I'm here. And it did. It changed my life.
Okay. As Maury Schwartz once said, once you learn how to die, you learn how to live.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, if we can embrace the fact that this is just a temporary stopover for us in the physical form, and we understand that death is going to be a part of our existence or our rebirth into a new existence, we learn to live a more meaningful life and not take any day for granted. Because as I've learned and you've learned, life can turn on a dime. When we have a plan, the universe says, hold my beer, here's my plan. Yeah. And it's either we align with that, we try to transcend challenges the universe has presented, or we end up dying, perhaps as physical and also spiritual death as well. So our life is defined by our ability to transcend challenge anyway. So,
yes. Yeah. And actually, one of the things that I do occasionally in groups, in person, and I've done them over Zoom, is a deathbed journey where I've taken the concept of, they do it in Buddhism, some deathbed meditations. They actually, some hardcore Buddhists, they even will go out to, in Tibet, they have what they call charnel ground, where it's not like a cemetery. It's just like bodies. This is where they put the bodies. And Buddhist monks would go and they would sit out there and they would meditate with dead bodies and look at the bodies and be like, that is me. That is me. That is me. That is me. Right? And so I took some of that, some other versions of, people call them, like, you know, all different things, end of life meditations, whatever you want. And then I took my shamanic journeying and I created this journey that I do with people where I take them to their deathbed and they die and they have to let go of everything. And I talk them through it, your house, your children, your stuff, your degrees, all of that, we're letting it go. It is dying. It is rotting. We're letting it go. And then at the end, there's like peace and silence. And there's the nothingness that comes after death, before whatever, right? Whether we're reborn or we go to heaven or whatever it is you believe. But then instead of that, I bring you back. And then at the end, I'm like, now you have the chance to live your life. You lost everything. Now, how are you going to live your life now that you have those things back? And people have told me afterwards, it's changed them. Not quite to the degree as a near-death experience has for people, because you talk to people that had near-death experiences, and some of them, they're not the greatest experiences. They've gone to places that they have described very scary places. But either way, they come back changed. And people have told me that that has really changed them, going through that process of letting everything go and saying goodbye to it and then coming back and being like, oh, but that's not real. Like, I really have this opportunity to appreciate those things. It's a beautiful practice. And I love when I do it, I'm still doing it, right? As I'm reading this script off to people, I'm going through it in my head. I'm imagining myself letting go of all those things, saying goodbye to my children and my husband and my car and my house and all those things. I love it. It's a beautiful practice.
Yeah, it's like the shamanic journeying version of post-traumatic growth.
Mm.
you know, in terms of you come back changed and you realize that material possessions aren't going to sustain you. All the accomplishments in the world aren't going to sustain you. It's the quality of the relationships that you have, the amount of love and compassion that you can show to yourself and others. And, you know, that's what it's about. And I know with Tedeschi and Calhoun's model of post-traumatic growth, one of the things is to change priorities and change relationships and change how what we view is important.
Yeah. And when you talk to people that are dying, I've talked to people that are nearing the end of life. They never talk about their stuff. They're not telling you about their houses and their cars. They'll tell you about their vacations, but not because it was like the fancy vacation in Paris, France. It's because they went to that fancy vacation in Paris, France, and they took their spouse or they took their children and they had the first baguette they've ever had. You know, like they're talking about the relationships. They're talking about those moments of connection and love. They're not talking about their stuff. Those are the things that people cherish and have to really let go of. And then unfortunately, there's also the regrets of, you know, I've talked to people that have lost marriages and they'll say, I was so selfish. I put my jobs and money and other women or men, whatever it is, over the love of my spouse. And now here I am. I'm dying and I wish that I would have made a different choice, that relationship meant so much more to me than I realized until I lost it. And now here I am alone, dying alone without anybody. It's sad, you know? And again, I love to hold that space for somebody because I know how healing that can be. But when you sit with somebody that's my children won't talk to me, my spouse hasn't talked to me, Where's all my money and my cars and all my stuff now as I lay here alone because nobody will even come sit with me? And I'm like, well, I'm here. I mean, that's not the best, but at least you're not alone because I would never want, I don't care who you are. I don't care what you've done. I've talked to people, they've murdered people, all kinds of crazy stuff. And I'm like, sure, here we are though together and you're dying and I'm here with you. I won't leave you alone. Because I think everybody deserves to have that. Because again, I don't know what their story was. I don't know how they got to that point where they took somebody else's life or did all these terrible things that they're telling me about. I don't know what their story was before that. And in that moment, I honestly don't care. I just want them to feel peace and acceptance about what is coming for them. Because we're all going to get there one day. I don't care how good or bad of a person you are. We're all going to die. It happens to everybody.
And in our next existence, what we did or didn't do isn't going to make a difference because it's all about love, light, and forgiveness, and just pure bliss.
Mm-hmm. And I hope that is true. That makes me feel good. I'm like, I hope so. Because sometimes this lifetime here, there really is a lot of sadness, suffering, and I really hope that all of us can transition to a better place where we don't have that suffering, where we can just be our real selves that we were before trauma.
You know, and I think from what I've read about individuals who have gotten a glimpse of the afterlife, whether it's been through near-death experiences or astral projection or traveling, the consistent accounts that we've gotten is that there's a world that is characterized by, you know, by those qualities that we talked about, love and light, and that, you know, where the colors are so much vibrant, where, you know, you're just accepted for who you are, and that what we did in this lifetime was meant for the greater evolution of our souls, and all is forgiven, all is forgotten when we, because we see each other's souls in a new dimension, and we don't see the human experience or the contracts that marred us seeing our souls in this lifetime. So
I love that. And again, I hope, because I don't know what I believe, honestly. Like, I feel like I believe there's something after this, that it's not just going to end. I don't think I'm going to die and it's just going to be like a light bulb turns off, but I don't know what it is. And so I don't know, but that's why I love to talk to people about it. You know, that's something that I really enjoy is hearing everybody's experiences and piecing together what potentially comes after this, but we're not going to know for sure until we get there. And I think that's okay too.
Yep. I was reading a book by Kent Nerburn called Wisdom in the Stones, Life Lessons from the Native Way. And he quoted a Lakota elder. And I always remember this when we're so focused on trying to solve puzzles in this lifetime, where he said to Kent Nerburn, life isn't a puzzle to be solved. It's a mystery to be honored. And I'm going to honor the mystery in terms of what happens when we get beyond this lifetime. And of course, I'll know it will get there. And if I can, I'll send a sign out to everybody who's still on Earth and just say, hey, this is beautiful up here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love that. I'm going to have to find that book too, because now I'm like, that sounds really cool. And yeah, I mean, kind of what I've told even my my daughter, she's 11, and she gets very stressed about the idea that one day she's going to have to live without me. And she'll say to me like, well, hopefully we'll just die at the same time. I'm like, no. Like, ideally, we're going to go in what I think of as hopefully the natural order of things, where I'm going to die before you and you're going to live longer than me. Again, I realistically know that could absolutely not be the path that we're going to go down. But I've told her that too, where I'm like, look, I'm like, when I do die, whenever that is, hopefully it's going to be a long time from now, you'll know that I'm here. I'm going to stick around with you. You'll know that I'm here with you, because I feel that way even with my grandmother, where sometimes it feels like she's still here. It feels like she's just sitting in the other room. I don't ever feel that she left me. And it's comforting. It genuinely feels like she's still here. I still miss that I can't go talk to her, can't go have tea with her, right? I can't do the physical things. But my soul feels like she's not gone. She's here somewhere, but she's here.
And I've come to believe that. And I've also learned that what we interpret as a sign or a nudge from our loved one or after death contact is always a product of what's going on with us in the present moment. I can't consensually validate whether your experience was real, because I didn't have that experience. But you know what I need to do as a bereavement support specialist, as a therapist, is I need to understand what that experience meant to you and how that transformed you. If it had a transformative effect on you, who am I to say it wasn't real? Because it was real for you, and I need to be able to validate that as a support specialist or a therapist. Not to judge whether or not it was real or not. If it was real to you, then it becomes real to me.
Yeah. And I love that. I love that you are able to support people in that, because it does seem, you know, I've even talked to people that have had a therapist and they talk about their experiences with death and grief and things that are outside of our normal understanding. And they get shut down. And I think that's sad. That's unfortunate. I don't know. I think I'm a Libra. So I'm very much like, I try to find the balance. I am very scientific minded. I'm also a little woo, right? So I got a little bit of both of them going on. And I feel like maybe science can't prove it yet. Doesn't mean that they won't be able to in the future. That there's spirits, or that there's other planes that we go to after we die. Or, I mean, I don't know, I've read books where they talk about there being different planets. Actually, my daughter, when she was 3 years old, she told me she came from a planet called Indigo. And I was like, and of course my husband was like, well, she probably just heard that color in school. I'm like, no 3-year-old hears the color Indigo. Like, where did that come? And she said she came from that planet before she got here. But then I had read a book years ago where a guy was saying that in between lifetimes, that is kind of where we go. It's like a different planet. So I was like, I don't know, maybe this much happened to her. And maybe she was here and she went to that planet and now she's back with me again. I don't know. But I love to think about it.
Yeah. It's something to research. When I heard Indigo, I thought immediately of Indigo children. And, you know, the work of P.H. Atwater and others who have researched indigo children with specific consistent characteristics across the board. So,
And actually, I don't think I know of them. I know of there's another one that they talk about with children. but I don't think I know of indigo children.
I would
give
it a shot and research that.
Because I tried looking for like somebody saying like the planet indigo. Like I tried looking for things like that. And I came across like a rock band that was called Planet Indigo. I'm like, well, that's not very helpful. No. I could not find much. And again, she's 11 now. So, you know, we're talking quite a few years ago. I think about it once in a while, but I haven't actually researched it again. So, yeah, so I'm going to have to love the indigo children. See, that's, I'm like, maybe she is. Like, I don't know. She's certainly something else, that's for sure.
Well, it sounds like she's a very creative, very intuitive young lady. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that in my book. So, you know, Jill, I could probably talk to you for about another 3 hours, but I know, I know you have a date with your mom.
Coming up, I do. Coffee date with my mom, because I have work I could do. But you know what? One day I'm going to look back at my coffee dates with my mom and they're going to be super special to me. So I'm going to take advantage of it while I can. But we're going to talk in like 2 weeks again. So
you got it. But before I let you go, please tell our audience how they can get in touch with you, find out more about your Seeing Death Clearly podcast, End of Life Clarity, how they can find you, how they can contact you. What's the best way for them to do that, Jill?
So my website and all of my social medias are End of Life Clarity. That's kind of a good place to just find me. Facebook, actually, I'm pretty active now. I wasn't as much. I have a Facebook group that is End of Life Clarity Circle. But if you find Jill McLennan, which I'm sure you'll have my full name in the show notes because that's not an easy one to spell, you could always friend request me on Facebook and I can link you to the Facebook group. The podcast is on all major podcast platforms. It's also linked on my website. I'm in the process of updating my website with my funeral celebrant training. So I'll be having some new offers on there, clarifying things a little bit more about what I do. But for real, anybody that needs any help, I work with people locally in New Jersey, but I really have actually done more work virtually with people around the country, just supporting them through the process of getting together an end of life care plan all the way to caregiving a loved one. I love this work. I'm super excited about talking with people and helping them navigate something that we all have to face.
Absolutely. And if the world can have more Jill McLennans in it to help us navigate end of life, the world would be a great place.
Yeah. We need more people doing this work and helping support families.
Absolutely. Jill, thank you so much for your time today. Truly enjoyed our conversation, and I know we're going to be doing this again soon.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dave. I appreciate you having me on your show.
You're welcome. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.